start with a couple of minutes sitting just to help us arrive, because some of us may have rushed to get here. So let's just sit quietly together for a few moments. Including Sandra's dog. So closing our eyes if we want to, and dropping into the body, the breath, the moment, this being here-ness. And let's see if we can really invite everything into awareness, bring everything with us. Don't leave anything outside the door, as it were. So we have an open, inclusive, loving, kindly awareness. In ourselves, with one another. Seeing if we can let go of what we've just been doing and let go of what's coming next. And have the adventure of just being with whatever arises with a loving, non-reactive awareness. It's a beautiful fragment of a poem by John O'Donohue that goes, "I would love to live like a river flows, full of the surprise of my own unfolding." So beautiful. I would love to live like a river flows, full of the surprise of my own unfolding. So let's see if we can bring that quality with us into the session. So now opening our eyes and bringing a little practice to a close. Okay, so today I'm going to be kind of drawing things together, both Satipatthana and Lojong, and then tomorrow morning we're going to have a practice morning. So we're going to bring everything into sitting together. And we'll be integrating everything we've learned into the mindfulness of breathing and the metta bhavana. So we kind of get a sense of how we can take it forwards into our daily practice with the traditional Tri Ratna practices. And we'll also do a body scan in the morning. This evening, we've got the talk from Arya Jaya on beauty and maybe some puja verses, maybe. So again, it will be, you know, receiving the gift of this evocation of different aspects of Tara and tonight's beauty, and then devotional practice of some sort. And then tomorrow night, we're going to have a sevenfold puja, and the rest of the team are organizing all that. And we're really trying to sort of get very creative about, well, how can we really include you all as if you are here in Tara's realm with us? Well, you are here in Tara's realm with us, as far as I'm concerned. But how can we help you really have a sense of that? So more information on that will follow. But it's exciting. Yeah. It's possible that things are arising for you that you would like to confess. This is completely normal on retreats, that we drop in on ourselves and things bubble up that maybe we realize are things that are holding us back, and that it would be, we'd really like to be able to soften. So we'd encourage you to write confessions out or find an object that represents the thing you want to let go of and to place it on your shrine at home. So we'd really encourage you to be actively engaging with confession as a practice. And then in the puja tomorrow night, we'll revisit that in some way for you to have a sense of ritually letting go of those things. But in the meantime, we'd really encourage you to be placing those things on your shrine at home. Which brings me to a diagram of what I call the energetic arc of a retreat. And I'm dropping this in now because we're kind of well into the retreat and you may be noticing a kind of process unfolding. I'm sure you are. And it seems that, I find it so fascinating about the human psyche. It seems that the human psyche goes through a kind of very sort of universal process, whether it's a weekend, whether it's a month, whether it's 3 months, whether it's a year. It seems that somehow we know how to, or the psyche just kind of unfolds in a certain way within whatever time frame we have of a retreat. So it starts with us arriving. And, you know, where maybe we just kind of arrive and we're a bit in our heads. We don't quite know what's going on. We do a whole load of settling, which is, and this retreat has been very much structured to support this process of unfolding. So you come into the body, breathing. You can think back to the beginning of the retreat where we had the diaphragm work and really just arriving, settling, resting. The whole first day, I was encouraging you all to nap. and to sleep and to rest and to arrive, yeah. And then what happens very, very often is that stuff comes up and we integrate new learnings. You know, things begin to bubble up. We have this field of awareness that's softening and opening and softening and opening, and maybe some things come up that are challenging. You think, oh no, that's what I do. That's awful. And then you kind of learn how to hold that with love and you let go and you be tender around it and so on. Maybe it's joyful. You have bliss, you have openness, you have very happy states of mind. And most of us get both. Most of us get both. You know, we get some challenging material and we get some joyful material. And by that, it might be very challenging or it might be a little bit challenging. It might be a little bit joyful or it might be very joyful. There's this whole kind of spectrum that we begin to drop in on and our awareness is broadening and opening. And certainly my own experience, when I'm in that phase, I may even get a little bit frightened about the retreat ending because I think, oh, I'm just too raw. Or I feel I've been sort of skinned in a certain kind of way. I haven't got my armor on. And it's like, oh no, how am I going to manage when I go home? Obviously you are all at home, but nonetheless, you're probably still having these kind of experiences. You know, how am I going to go back to work next week or whatever? But it's almost like magic. Something then happens where the psyche knows, okay, it's time to calm, settle and assimilate. And somehow when the end of the retreat comes, we're kind of ready for it. Not always, not universally, but generally. And then we're ready to take the retreat learning into life. So I just think it's interesting. I kind of wish I'd shared this with you at the beginning, but I forgot. But nonetheless, I'm sharing it with you now. And you can take it into your next retreat that you go on. But I find that really fascinating. I've just seen this again and again and again in my own experience. And the many, many people I've been on retreat with. And the sense I get from talking to some people is that yesterday was a tender day. We were probably somewhere at the top of that arc. And then we're guiding, you know, we'll be guiding you out of that arc and how to settle, calm, assimilate. So that's why we have a practice morning tomorrow. So you can just really kind of ground and settle, assimilate and absorb. Okay, so we're just going to do a little bit of a summary of Satipatthana, which will include just touching on the Dhammas section. Okay, so this is a lot of words. It's a Dhamma, it's a really beautiful Dhammarati diagram. But I wanted to, even though it's quite hard to see, it's quite tough, small text, I just wanted to offer it today, and I'm just, you just look at it very big picture. But it's the whole sutta in one page. I feel very, very grateful to Dhammarati, because I've done one myself that I've used for years, and I was on retreat with him, and he's a really excellent designer. So he took it upon himself to have another go. And he's done a much better job. But the main thing to see is that the sutta's all about two trends. On the top half, we've got the trend that leads to suffering. And on the bottom half, we've got the trend that leads to freedom. I can see someone taking a photo of this, and just to say, I'll put this on the Padlet later on. Yeah. He's probably not entirely satisfied with it yet, but it's certainly, I think it's highly satisfactory. So we've got the body section on the left. We're aware of the breath, we're aware of postures, we're aware of all these different activities, we're aware of the body parts, we're aware of the elements, and we're aware of the corpse, you know, everything. All, everything about us is going to end up just as dust. So very sort of deep reflections there. Then we have Vedana, which is the orangey color. And for those of you who can't see this, it doesn't matter, because I'm explaining at all. So we have the orangey color, which is Vedana. Feeling tone, this very initial arising. And actually somebody asked a very important question about where does Vedana come from? You know, does it come from sense impressions? They thought it probably did, and yes, it does. I haven't made that very clear. But in the, if you remember the wheel of life and the Nidana chain, you've got the six senses. The six senses come into contact with experience, sense objects, and then we get this arising of Vedana. And we have worldly and unworldly. I've touched on that. So the worldly is kind of ordinary experience. It's when we're very in the senses, we're very bound up with identification with the object. And then the unworldly is where we're dropping in on awareness itself, the quality of awareness itself, rather than being so caught up with the sense object. Yeah. And I was saying that pleasant is the kind of feelings we get in meditation. Or outside meditation, you're just this kind of, oh, this really pleasant sun on the skin. You're not grasping, you're not craving, but there's an opening that happens with that. Neutral equanimity. Unpleasant is where we're kind of aware that there's further to go. And that's kind of got a kind of, oh, it's a little bit unpleasant because it's challenging, but it's also, you think, oh, yes, I'm sort of on the scent of something. And if I can stay with that, then my heart will open, my mind will open. Then we've got Chitta, which is the green box. Mind. And again, we've got these two trends. Top half is where the mind is not moving towards freedom. It's narrow, surpassable, unconcentrated, unliberated. The three poisons are present: greed, hatred, delusion, lustful, angry, deluded. It's contracted, it's distracted. Or we have the bottom trend, without lust, without anger, without delusion. It's great, it's unsurpassable, it's concentrated, it's liberated. So all the things we've covered so far. And then the Dhammas section is a number of Dharmic lists. It's the hindrances, it's the awakening factors, it's the aggregates or the skandhas, it's the six sense spheres, and it's the four noble truths. Yeah. So the generally speaking, the hindrances and the awakening factors are considered the heart of this. It's the sections that are there in all the different versions of the sutta. So you can see, you know, if we're going down the route of contraction, we've had the Vedana, we've sort of closed down around it with grasping, with pushing away, with delusion, confusion. then the hindrances are another expression of those tendencies. So this craving sense experiences, aversion, restlessness and worry, sloth and torpor, or doubt. So those are the classic five hindrances. And in terms of the Four Noble Truths, that's the first two noble truths of dukkha. There is dukkha, and there's the arising of dukkha based on craving, aversion, and so on. The bottom half, if we're able to stay with our Vedana in this non-reactive way, just release around it, soften, open, the chitta becomes more open, and we end up with the awakening factors, which is it's a form of a spiral path. So there's mindfulness, investigation of dhammas, energy, joy, tranquility, concentration, equanimity. So that's a progressive form of a spiral path. And we end up with the cessation of dukkha and the path leading to the cessation of dukkha. So I really like this because it's a way of getting the whole map. And in some ways it's, you know, it is just very, very clear and simple. It's what we do with our awareness of our experience. And that's what we've been practicing all this week. Do we close down? Do we release? And through conditioned co-production, through the natural process of this being that becomes, through the natural process of what we dwell on, we become, if we learn to dwell upon these more open states, we will quite naturally end up at freedom. It's terribly encouraging. It's like we don't really have to do anything else other than know what's happening and then be very skillful and sensitive to how do we respond to what's happening. So yeah, I'll put that on the Padlet. And then if we want to have it even simpler, from Analio, it's keep calmly knowing change. Keep calmly knowing change. So there's a quality of, could everyone check that they're muted, please? Somebody's unmuted. Good, thank you. So the keep is a quality of continuity of purpose. We have sort of appropriate effort, keeping on the path, calm, this mind that's not sort of hot with the poisons, knowing, insight, change, impermanence, and by implication, emptiness. So beautiful. Keep calmly knowing change. So as I've said a number of times, what we're doing in Satipatthana practice is where as if we're looking in a mirror. I mean, this is a metaphor, obviously, but what we're doing is we're turning awareness in on the functioning of our own sort of internal world and getting very curious. And through that process, we get to know what's happening very directly. And then we have this extraordinary opportunity for choice that we can move from a reactive mind to a creative mind. And I really love Bhante's teaching on mind creative, not reactive, which is describing this process. I love that language of a creative mind rather than a reactive mind. We can only do that if we're aware. So awareness is the absolute crucial element. So a few metaphors and images for working with mental tendencies. They could fit into either dhammas or chitta, but I think really I'm just offering them because some of us like these metaphors and images rather than all being kind of a bit conceptual. So one of them is to imagine a snowball going down a hill, and that's what our thoughts and emotions can feel like when we're not aware. And of course, a snowball going down a hill just gets bigger and bigger and bigger, doesn't it? And can't it feel like that? You know, when you're really in the grip of something, it's rolling down, 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 getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and getting quite a bit of speed up as well as it rolls down the hill. So if we imagine, this is obviously imaginal, you've got a hill and now somehow magically you can balance that, you're going to make the hill level and the snowball just stops. snowboard just stops. So that's what we're doing with our awareness. It's a bit like we think, oh, I've got a snowboard. How can I, using imagination, a bit of sort of magical imagination, think, wow, I can actually change this hill. So it's not a hill anymore, it's just a lovely level field. And look, my snowball's not going anywhere. And then maybe the sun comes out and the snowball melts. That's amazing. I just thought of that. That's really good, isn't it? The sunlight of your awareness melts the snowball. There's just nothing left. So that's a really interesting image that you could play with. Training a puppy. Doesn't your mind feel like that sometimes? It's just chasing after really exciting sense impression, stimulus. You call it back, sort of wanders beside you for about 1 nanosecond and then chases off after another really interesting sense impression. But we can train our mind like training a dog. And I really like this image because the dog looks really happy. So this is an image of a dog just walking beside its owner. There's no lead, interestingly. It looks happy, bright, free, but it's also walking very much in harmony with the owner. So it's a bit like we are training our mind so they can be like a well-trained puppy that just really wants to, he finds it very, very interesting to walk beside rather than run off. So that's another good image. Now, I really love this one. When our mind is ensnared by thoughts, emotions, it's a bit like we're a great big stag with huge antlers trying to walk through undergrowth. And what happens? You really don't get very far, do you? And it all gets all tangled up, and probably the stag is trying to sort of wrench itself free. But the more you try and wrench it free, the more tangled up you get. And I quite like the word snagging, which probably isn't a great word for those of you who don't speak English, but snagging means you're sort of catching. So I've got my cardigan here, and if I had something on my wrist with little spiky bits and I rubbed it over my cardigan, it will get all snaggy and all these threads would pull. So I think the mind snags on experience and gets kind of stuck and a bit gritty. So we don't want to be like the stag with its antlers tangled up in the undergrowth. We want to be like a fox. So a fox just slides through the undergrowth, finding its way. It's very beautiful. It's very kind of sleek. So we want to be like a fox rather than a stag with great big antlers. And what's interesting there with this metaphor is the undergrowth is all still there. It's not like the undergrowth has gone away, which is, you know, the thousands of thoughts pouring through the mind every day. But the attitude to those thoughts has completely changed from one of snagging to one of just kind of knowing how to gently work with what's arising. Very traditional image is that the untrained mind is like a monkey in a tree. And I mean, I don't live in a country where there are monkeys, and I never have, so I don't exactly know how monkeys behave, but my sense is that they are just very active, jumping around in the tree, chasing after impressions. There's a nice bit of fruit. There's something exciting over there. Oh, there's something exciting over there. So something comes in. Dhamma Megha's nodding. Do you have monkeys in South Africa?
I was in Zambia.
Sorry?
Yeah, in one part of
South Africa. Yeah. So she's nodding that I've got this right. So they're very activated by exciting things to chase after. So this is a very traditional image of the untrained mind. And then the trained mind can be like an elephant. Very stable, very steady, very grounded. I think elephants are also very wise, apparently. And apparently, I don't know this for sure, elephants find it quite difficult to turn their head, to twist their head. So generally speaking, when they're looking at something, they turn the whole body and then they really attend. And I think I love that, because when we're not that mindful, it is a bit like we're just kind of looking at something over here and looking at something over there. But wouldn't it be amazing if you just like, oh, there's something over there. Good. I'm going to just fully attend. come back. Emails. I'm just going to do my emails for half an hour without getting distracted by my phone. Because it's more like we're doing emails. Oh, phone. Emails, phone. Just like attending to one thing at a time. And then another image is to be like a lion. And I've got a quote, and I can't remember where I got it from, but a teacher was talking to a student, and he says, when you throw stones, if you throw a stone and you've got a dog, what does the dog do? And the student says, oh, the dog chases after the stone, runs after the stone. Yeah. And then he said, and if you throw a stone and there's a lion, what does the lion do?
Chases after you.
Well, that's not quite the right metaphor, because could get eaten. But what the lion does will turn to look at the person that's throwing the stone. Mm. That's so good, isn't it? Mm. And of course, the person that's throwing the stone, in a way, is your own mind. Mm. So you rather than being like the dog chasing after the thoughts, you become like the lion who's attending to the nature of mind itself. That's a good one, isn't it? Mm. And of course, lions are also very, very stable, powerful creatures. So there's two kind of main approaches to working with thoughts and emotions, broadly speaking. The first one is to bring the power of the mind back to the stake of mindfulness. This is the one that you will have all been taught, you know, when you wander off, just come back to the breath. You wander off, you come back to the breath. So the image here is the mind is like a bull, or I think that's a water buffalo in the image. And the tree is the stake of mindfulness, and the rope is your breath. So you just keep on coming back, and the water buffalo here is quite happy. It's just resting, lying down in the sun. And this works very well for a lot of the sort of chatter that we have in the mind. So stuff is relatively kind of lightweight, just chit chat. You just keep coming back and the mind will eventually settle. And I always say to people, start with that. Make that your first sort of port of call, to just keep coming back and hopefully the mind will settle. But of course, there's some experiences that really doesn't work for, and I'm sure you've all experienced this. Generally, it's experiences which are emotionally charged, that are really demanding attention, and you keep on letting it go, coming back, you let it go, come to the body and the breath, bounce back. You come back, bounce back, come back, bounce back, come back. And eventually it just becomes a bit exhausting and even can provoke tension. So then what you move on to is give your mind a big field and you take your mindfulness with you. So let's say I've got a job interview on Monday, which I haven't, but let's just say I did. And I was really, really anxious about that job interview. And I'm sitting here thinking, oh, let it go, come back, let it go, come back. Oh, but I'm really nervous, let it go, come back. But I'm really, really nervous, let it go. But what shall I say? Let it go. But what if they don't like me? Let it go. You know, you're not really getting anywhere. So the next method is, I'm really, really nervous. Let me just acknowledge that. Let me breathe into that nervousness. And let me breathe out love. Let me just breathe with that experience of anxiety. So I'm really acknowledging it. In a sense, you know, I'm turning towards it in the ways we've been talking about, not over focusing, but I'm letting it into my field of awareness and I'm breathing with it. So the image here is to be like a horse whisperer, and I've got a picture here of a person training a horse. And what horse whisperers do, it's really amazing, is that they don't oppose the energy of the horse. So it's a way of training wild horses. And they let the horse have its own kind of momentum, and they give it a very long lead. And then eventually what you do is that you get what's called join up, which is where the horse will come to you. And there's this moment of connection. Very, very, very beautiful. You can read about this from a guy called Monty Roberts, who's written a book about horse whispering. So we can become mind whisperers. So in that example of anxiety, breathing in, really anxious, breathing out, I'm aware of anxiety. Just kind of let the energy be there. Don't oppose that energy of the anxiety. Breathe with it, ground, be in my body. Where am I feeling that anxiety in my body? Oh, it's a pit in my stomach. Let's just breathe with that, settle. And then eventually you will come to a place of greater calm through having acknowledged that anxiety, not trying to sort of suppress it, but you just very gradually come, you know, where's that in the body? Come to that more sort of grounded physical expression of the anxiety, and then eventually shift your awareness a little, rather than being weighted to the anxiety, it becomes a little bit more weighted to breathing. So that's another way of working, and to be a mind whisperer. And then what we're really trying to do is to live with open hands, as I've said a number of times. Just notice this kind of stance against life, closing down around a kind of this illusion of permanence in oneself, pushing away, pulling in, what I call the push me, pull you mind, where we're just kind of pushing and shoving at experience. Do you notice that in yourselves ever? It's kind of, I think pushing and shoving is a good description. We learn to release, and we either do that, you know, if it's just kind of chit chat, we just come back to the body. If it's more charged, we really acknowledge that with love, with kindness, and then very gradually guide ourselves back to a more integrated sense of wholeness. Okay, let's do a practice together. Have a little taste of bringing this all together in the ways that I've just described. Before we begin, let's have 1 minute to stand up, stretch our bodies if we want to. Okay, so let's settle. So Zara has put something in the chat box, which is interesting. She said, I heard a useful image from a neuroscientist recently. The area of the brain where we process bodily sensation is the same area where we experience creativity. So each time we shift attention from the ruminating part of the mind to this part, we create pathways to this more open creative space. Yeah, very interesting. Thank you, Zara. Because that's what it feels like, actually, when one comes out of rumination and we just come back into our direct sense impressions in the body. Something happens, something frees up a little bit in the mind. Thank you. Okay, so if we settle back into our position, find our seat, and if we're lying down, the metaphorical equivalent of that, this kind of body, heart, mind, memory of our meditation stance. We want to, we could take a deeper in-breath, and on the out-breath, releasing, arriving, letting go. Do that a few times if you want to. We're ready, allowing our breathing to find its own natural rhythm. First of all, let's have a broad sense of the body, the heart, the mind. What's the general weather? Think of how the quality of our awareness can be tender, loving, curious, sensitive. And allowing our awareness, if it's still feeling a bit heady, to kind of slide down out of that limb. The head is a limb of the body, and down to include the rest of the body, the torso, the legs, the arms. And having a sense of this kind of unified whole sense of embodying as a process, as a verb, moment by moment. There's the weight, there's the shape, there's the movement and sensations of breathing in the whole body, all the diaphragms open, participating. I always like imagining or getting a felt sense that the volume of my whole body is opening a little bit in all directions on the in-breath, subsiding a little bit in all directions on the out-breath. Can we let that be without interfering, without pushing, without inhibiting? It's a kind of quality of awareness, like very, very deep listening to this rhythm, this experience in the whole body. Not listening through the ear, of course, but some sort of quality of receptivity. as our Vedana. This field of pleasant, unpleasant, neutral feeling tone. The initial arising independence upon sense impressions, independence on sensation. Not being too earnest, bringing a quality of play, curiosity and interest. Ah, this is unpleasant, this is pleasant. Now I'm closing down, ah, release. If it's all a bit dull, you can remember this beautiful line from the Rumi poem. You're covered with thick cloud, slide out the side, become like someone suddenly born into colour. See if we can, again metaphorically of course, but have the sense of the Vedana suddenly becoming more vivid, more known, more aware. What sort of thoughts and emotions are flowing through your experience? Be careful not to judge. What we're doing here is we're familiarizing ourselves. Being an inward-bound adventurer, an inward-bound warrior, compassionate warrior. You've got an experience that feels charged, that's calling for attention. Perhaps practice being a mind whisperer, giving your mind and heart a big field and then very gradually guide it back inside breathing, inside the body, this place of stability. And can you have a sense of resting and a felt quality of openness as we let go of contracting around our experience? We get these glimpses, these tastes of what it's like to have a mind that's liberating. It's resting in the awareness that was there all the time. And if you're not experiencing this, you're just really aware of bound states, then knowing that the awareness of the bound states is mindfulness, it is wakefulness. That is also the practice. And seeing if you can bring tenderness, love, metta to that experience. Now let's bring the weight of the body to the foreground of awareness, really feeling into the contact with the support and receiving the support of the floor, chair, the sofa, bed, whatever it might be, yielding, releasing, settling, absorbing. Been curious about the transition. Transitions are so interesting. I think what we often do is the bell goes and we just switch off. But seeing if we can use the bell as an invitation to a transition, to take awareness into something else. A bit of engagement, moving the body. Yeah, and I'm just curious, maybe I've got time to hear from one person about what happened in that practice for you. What did you notice? Ali.
Towards the end of that meditation, I noticed that there wasn't a me sitting on the sofa.
Ah, yeah.
It was, yeah, there were no boundaries.
Yeah. Pleasant, unpleasant, neutral?
Interesting and curious.
Okay. Yeah.
I didn't have a version to it. It was more of a noticing, this is what it's like. This is what it feels like.
Yeah. Yeah. So what were you, so that's kind of aware of an absence of me, the what's sometimes called the burden of the self.
Mm-hmm. What that's was, a nice word.
Yeah. So what was present?
A depth.
Depth. Okay. Mm. Yeah. Any activity in the mind?
A noticing of, Oh, this is an interesting experience.
Yeah.
But not getting caught up in trying to work out what the experience was.
Yeah.
Just noticing, this is happening.
Mm.
I'm not judging it. I'm not layering it.
Yeah, good.
Mm. It was lovely.
Yeah. Yeah, good. Yeah, so... The interesting thing now is because, of course, when we have these kind of experiences, of course, we want them again. And then as soon as we want them again, they don't happen.
Yep. I had that a few days ago. I had the most heart-opening experience that I think I've ever had in meditation about 2 days ago. And the next time I sat, it was like, ooh. But of course, like you said, it doesn't happen again.
Yeah, exactly. So then it's how do you just have that very tender sort of opening to possibility and seeing what happens. Yeah, brilliant. Thank you. Thank you, Ali. Okay, so we've got Kaz. This will be the last one and then we'll have a break. Yeah, Kaz.
Hello. I've got ADD. So, and my son's got ADHD. So I really found that being a mind whisperer really, really helpful. Just being able to be in that space of having lots of energy and allowing it to be there, you know, rather than trying to access practice that's presented, generally speaking, by neurotypical people. I just found that really, really helpful.
Mm-hmm.
That was lovely. Thank you.
And what happened in your actual experience as you allowed in that possibility, what happened to your energy, for example?
Oh, it's just, I can still feel it. It's really high. I had to stand up. I was just yawning constantly, just feeling this great sense of like bringing in just whatever's around.
Yeah.
And just being free to just be whatever I needed to do and just move and stretch and bend. And I realized at one point I had a few tears streaming down my cheeks, but I wasn't, there's no sense of sadness or anything. I think it was just a beautiful sense of freedom being in the experience that I had.
Mm. And so good that you allowed yourself to move. You know, you didn't, because I think what we can do, what you're describing very well, is we think, you know, I should be just really sort of calm and still. You've got all this energy and you keep on sort of trying to drag it back. And there's all this kind of tension that gets created. But to just allow the energy, let it do its thing, take awareness with you, of course, and then very gradually learn how to work on those edges, I think is very, very, very helpful. So thank you for describing that. Yeah, and it reminds me of something. I'll just drop this in quickly little point, and then we'll have a break. That I did a session recently, some training recently with a physio who works a lot with people with aroused nervous systems. And someone the other day had also asked about trauma sensitive, you know, what do we do with trauma? And it's all kind of related. So either from trauma or the sort of thing that Kaz is talking about, or pain or whatever it might be. And trauma doesn't need to be a huge thing. You know, some of the thinking these days is that there's sort of lots of little micro traumas that happen that become conditioned into our nervous system. But the outcome is we have this kind of dysregulated nervous system where maybe our energy is very aroused. And then to go into calm is too much. This is what this physio was saying. It's too difficult to go from being high to being still. So what she advocates, and I find it's very, very interesting, is to access positive arousal rather than just being a sort of threat arousal. We access positive arousal, and she suggests doing that through dance and music. So I can't remember what song she used. It was from Jungle Book. What are the songs in Jungle Book?
King of the Jungle.
No, it wasn't that one.
Bare Necessities.
Bare Necessities. Thank you. So she had us all dancing around to Bare Necessities. It was absolutely brilliant. And she was, this was very moving. She said during the early stage of the pandemic, she works in the health service in Jersey. She got redeployed. They all got redeployed, you know, to deal with the huge crisis. And at one point she was doing a session for a whole load of senior clinicians. They're all in a big lecture theater, you know, how to deal with this. arousal, and she got them all up and dancing to Bare Necessities. And she said they loved it, you know, kind of breaks out of that state. So dance and movement, you know, if you're feeling really wired, sometimes meditators too, it's not the right thing to do. So to transition from threat arousal to pleasure arousal, and then out of that, maybe it's going to be a bit easier to drop into calm. So I really wanted to drop that in as a suggestion. Bare Necessities is very, very good. Lovely, it's a lovely video on YouTube, little cartoons. And she and her team, they did a lot of research around what's going to be the best music, and they arrived on that. And then she also was encouraging us, and I'd really suggest this to you guys, she was encouraging us to have our own playlists of, you know, if you're feeling really wired, what's the music that's going to help? If you're sad, what will help you either, you know, if you're someone who tends to be a bit blocked, what will help you access sadness? If you're someone who gets overwhelmed, what will help you kind of stabilize sadness? So very, very good. You know, come up with your own playlist and use music. Good. So on that note, let's have a little break. I was going to actually play Bare Necessities on the retreat, but then I thought, well, your heads are all just going to be full of that tune for the rest of the retreat. So I think better off that you don't do it now. I'm very aware that we've all got contrary minds. Some of you will think, oh, well, I'll just go off and do it then, because she's told me not to. So you could just notice that arising and You do have a choice. But after the retreat, have a good old bop to Bare Necessities, a good old dance. It's wonderful. So let's just have 10 minutes, come back at 22, and then we'll move on to the next section. Maybe 43, so you get a good 10 minutes. Okay, so as always, second half of the morning, we're moving on to the bodhicitta dimension and trying to summarize it a bit today, and then we'll do another little practice together, and then this afternoon we'll have a longer practice as always. Right, is that the correct view? Good. Lojong, mind training. And that lovely picture of Atisha, the great, great master. Bodhisattva, bigger. And I'm just thinking he's got the mudra in that picture that Tara had. Similar mudra with his right hand. Yeah. So the metaphor I've offered is that the Satipatthana, where kind of looking in the mirror, really getting to know what does it mean to be human, my particular little version of that. And then the mirror becomes a window. We look out. It's like, wow, you know, I'm not alone. We've got 7 billion people just like me. So the extent that I know myself by imaginative engagement, I know you, I know others. That all these drivers that I have in me, you've got in broadly similar ways. So just to summarize, Alan Wallace, who's very, very, very good on all this material, he's written this book called Buddhism with Attitude, which I've got a funny feeling is out of print, but you might be able to get a hold of it somewhere. He says there's two criteria on which to judge the efficacy of this path. Firstly, that the reification of self is decreasing. If the sense of I am is getting lighter, ultimate bodhicitta works on this through the realization of emptiness, the lack of inherent existence of phenomena, including yourself. And I've highlighted the word inherent because clearly we do exist as this flow of conditioned processes. Like I'm here, it's not like I don't exist at all. But if I go looking in my experience for something that is my essential vidyamalaness, I will come away empty-handed. And I think what Ali was describing was a little taste of this. There's no me meditating, there's just experience, yeah? And then secondly, that your self-centeredness or self-importance is diminishing. Self-centeredness is the sense that your own personal well-being is your number one priority. The attitude that proclaims me and mine first. Relative bodhicitta works on this with exchange of self and other. Exchange of self-centeredness, this kind of self-importance in the sense that I am the most important thing, for awareness of other. I'll say more about that in a moment because it's fraught with potential misunderstandings. He says, enlightenment in a nutshell is decreasing self-grasping and decreasing self-centeredness and this kind of inflated self-importance. Obviously, we are important, but this inflated self-importance where we're always preferencing ourselves over others. And the first two points of the seven-point mind training cover the heart of Buddhist theory and practice. Why would you need anything more? So the first two points is the preliminaries that you've been reciting every morning. And then the second point is the main practice. And in a moment, I'm just going to remind you of those verses. And the remaining 5 points of the 7-point mind training are practices for day-to-day living. And this is very important. Turn boulders into stepping stones. Do you remember that one? I love that one. Turn boulders into stepping stones. And then Bhante, very, very good on this metta, the heart side of practice. He says metta is an outward movement of the self rather than from the self. As we continually expand the scope of our care and concern, The self is universalized, one might say, or expanded indefinitely. So we're not kind of crushing who we are or exterminating who we are through preference other, but it's more, we know through the Satipatthana, we're really getting to know ourselves well, and then our field of interest, our field of love broadens infinitely. This does not mean that we have to transform our sense of who we are according to an idea of how we should be that is quite alien to how we experience ourselves. And of course, this is another real near enemy of practice. We keep thinking, oh, I should be really loving, but actually I'm not. So he's saying, no, we're just aware of ourselves, and then gradually we train ourselves to open. It is rather that our direct experience of ourselves should be that we are continually going out to be aware of and concerned for the well-being of others, not fixed on any single point of identity. I think that's very, very good. And again, Ali gave us a little taste of the experience where we're no longer fixed on a single point of identity. And then when we bring metta to the fore, it's quite natural to love. It's quite natural to feel deeply, deeply connected. Because the idea of separation starts to become meaningless. Separation in the sense of it being a sort of like a concrete boundary around us. Of course, we need boundaries in life in order to function, but boundaries that are sort of adaptable, flexible, that we're aware of, appropriate. So this is my rendering of the second point. And Alan Wallace just said the first and the two points are the essence of the Dharma life. Preliminaries are the first point, and this is my rendering of the second point. Cultivate empathy and experience all beings as kin. Deep down, we are so alike. Nobody wants to suffer, and we all seek happiness. Exchange self and other. Exchange self-centeredness and other. Love others. Mount this on the breath. Do this with joy. Practice caring about others as much as yourself as an antidote to habitual self-importance and clinging. Whatever you experience, think of others. Use every experience as a gateway to empathy and always wish others well. Practice Tonglen on the spot at all times. So that means whenever you notice the kind of resistant mind, turn towards that, breathe it in, soften, release, and let go. Breathe out. Freedom. Freedom from contraction. Now I've got you, got all these little people in the way of the next bit. Okay, that's better. Come up with slogans to help you change your default setting from identifying with an illusory autonomous self to living with compassion for all. And we've got this most wonderful list of slogans from all you guys now, and we're going to incorporate that into the puja, read them all out in some way. So always come up with slogans. Okay, so this is just a little aside now. Cherish dharmic conundrums. Yeah, so if you come up with something in your practice, you think, I really don't like that. I really don't get that. I don't understand it. I don't know what's meant by it. That is brilliant. That's really brilliant. And make that something to chew on. And see if you can let it get under your skin. Yeah, I think these are, when I get these things, I think, oh, good. So for years I had one that was, why is compassion the expression of wisdom? That did not seem immediately obvious to me at all. It's like wisdom is seeing into sort of the boundless nature of mind. I thought, great, I really want that. But what's compassion got to do with it? You know, why compassion? So I made that my dharmic knot for years. And I think I've made some progress with that. So the sense of the nature of that free mind is also interconnectedness. But I'm not going to give you the answer. You might think, oh, yeah. Why is compassion the expression of wisdom? Take that away, make it your thing. And yesterday, someone sent me a question, which was about the reading I gave yesterday from Shantideva, and that in this group, people really hadn't liked it. Thought it sounded like being a martyr, didn't sound very inspiring, very idealistic, very challenging. And it sounded like this, it might be, you know, you're just exterminating the self and just thinking of others. So of course, when you get a question, you think, oh gosh, well, yeah, what would I say to that? So that got under my skin. So I was lying, I didn't really get much sleep last night because it was like, what does it mean, exchanging self another? What does it mean? That's outrageous. Exchanging self another. What does it mean? Exchanging self another. Go to sleep. What does it mean? Exchanging self another. So it was just kind of rumbling around, yeah? Because it is a kind of totally outrageous statement, just taken as it stands in English. As I said the other day, I think it's things are lost in translation. And I think it's shorthand for other things, but you know, what the hell does that mean? So that was rumbling around. And I thought, oh, good. You know, I'm on the edge. It's really good when you notice you're on the edge of your understanding. Cherish that. That's the main point I want to make now. You know, I'm sharing you mine, but that's kind of mine. But when you come across something dharmic, which you know is true, there's a kind of yes, but it's very confounding. It's very confounding. You can't work it out. Cherish that and make it something that just rumbles around in your being. And I think we can do that two ways. We could probably do it lots of ways, but I'm going to suggest two ways. One is intellectually. So we sort of use the mind to think something through. I think, is it one of Bhante's poems where he says, thinking it through, always thinking it through? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And when you read Bhante's autobiographies, you know, he obviously, when he was a young man in India, he would just spend tons of time reflecting, walking up and down the veranda, just reflecting on the Dharma. So we can do it intellectually. And, you know, I think the way I've done that with self and exchanging self another is, oh, it means exchanging this kind of self-centeredness for being other regarding. And I'm kind of satisfied with that intellectually, but I'm sure there's further to go. But then you get the question, well, why does Tonglin focus on suffering? You know, surely metta is enough. Why is there all this stuff about suffering? You know, it's so heavy and kind of a bit, you know, kind of, yeah, heavy. Why? Why suffering? So that's another great question. And then in the night, it sort of came to me like, oh, yes, I get it, briefly. And then it slithered away again. But like, and I had a moment of saying, oh, that works so brilliantly with Satipatthana, which I know, but I got a bit more clarity, because in Satipatthana, we're becoming aware of this push me, pull your mind, you know, the how habitual it is to turn away from pain and to hold on to happiness. And the Buddha says this is the cause of all our suffering. Grasping, the grasping mind is the cause of all our suffering. And that includes aversion, of course, aversion being the flip side of grasping. So, you know, we're all on this endless quest to avoid pain and to hold on to happiness. If you don't agree with that, you could reflect on it. But it seems that it's pretty true, as far as I can see, that if we really look deeply, that's a deep motivation. How can I avoid pain and how can I be happy all the time? And all this kind of pushing and shoving in the mind is driven by these twin impulses. And then in Satipatthana, we're learning to notice that and to release into this much more expansive awareness. And then we also know from the teachings that this awareness we're relaxing into is also full of love. And even then that is a brilliant thing to reflect on. Why? What the hell does that mean? And that's what my thing was for years, you know. Why is compassion the expression of wisdom? And then what we're doing in Tonglen, and it's interesting, you know, it's Lo Jong, which means mind training. It's not an existential statement, but it's a training. So we're doing something to actively reverse this. Ooh, don't like it. Oh, I want this just for me. That causes us so much suffering. So we're reversing that. We're just flipping it, flipping the whole thing. So let's open to discomfort And when we do that with a loving awareness, we're softening this natural aversion, this kind of I don't like it reaction that causes us so much grief. And then if we've got something that's good, we share it. We share it. We don't think, oh, it's mine. I want it forever. I don't want you to have it. If you have a bit of it, then I'm going to lose. You realize, oh, sharing is good for everybody. Because, of course, we can have this fear that if we share, we're going to be diminished. But the teaching is saying, and I'm sure we all have this in our experience, that to be generous and open-hearted leads to joy for oneself as well. So then I was thinking about, okay, what's the kind of emotion or what are metaphors? What's the story even that would help me remember this? Because I don't really want to have to go through a whole kind of intellectual exercise every time I'm encountering suffering. I want it to be immediate. That's the training. Immediately, just open and love, open and love. That's the training. So then I was thinking about how there's something about our minds, our ignorant minds, that complicates things. And I think this Tonglen thing, this Tonglen response is actually completely natural to us. So we're aligning ourselves with something that we know. It's not like suddenly I've got to sort of add on an attitude that's unfamiliar. It's more that we just need to remember, keep on remembering. I know this. I know what it's like to share. And I know what it's like to be kind. I know that. So a really good example that one of the teaching gives is that you're on a bus. You're sitting there on your seat, quite comfy. And then someone gets onto the bus. Maybe they've got a child on one hip. They've got a pushchair. They've got a whole bag, loads of bags of shopping. There's no seats left on the bus. It's completely natural to stand up and offer that person your seat. You know, that is something we've all done hundreds of times, I would think. I mean, obviously, I'm using this as a story. Those of us who are disabled, can't do that. But we will do other things in our own way. So really, Tonglen is just getting at that, because what you're doing is you're giving up your little bit of comfort. You're on the seat, you have to stand. That's a little bit less comfortable. And you're giving someone else, you're sharing the seat. And then you can do that in a grumpy way, and then stand there feeling irritable. Or you can do that in the way where you stand up and then you engage with these little children. I mean, I'm sure you know what this feels like. Hello, how are you? Where have you been? That's nice shopping. What have you got there? Oh, that's a nice coat. And suddenly you've got this, you are getting so much through entering into relationship with this person that got onto the bus all struggling with these crying children, and you've got into relationship and everyone's happy. So I think that's a really great example. By giving up a little bit of your comfort, you've ended up much happier. They've ended up much happier. And then I was trying to think of a story in the middle of the night that could evoke this as well. And I thought, well, okay, say it's a winter's night and you're in your house and you're quite comfy. You're watching your really favorite program on TV. Yeah. Like you're really totally into it, to the extent you've even turned your phone off because you don't want to be disturbed. And then there's a knock at the door and you think, oh no, it's a knock at the door. Maybe you even think, I'm just going to ignore it for a little while. And then eventually you think, no, I'll go to the door. So you crankily and grumpily get up, go to the door, open the door, and it's your neighbor. Maybe you don't even know the neighbor very well, so it's kind of a neutral person. And maybe you have a response of immediately, oh no, it's them. Or you might just be quite open. And anyway, the neighbor then says, oh, look, I've just been on holiday. I've come back and I put the house key under a rock in my garden and I can't find it. So I don't know what to do. Yeah. So you could have a response of thinking, oh God, just sod off and close the door on their face and go back to watching your TV program. So you're holding on to what you've got, my TV program, go away. Now, would that make you happy? I don't really think it would, because you're just left with this kind of, you've been a bit harsh, and you know that they're still standing on your doorstep, having had the door closed in their face. You could think, oh, well, I suppose I'll help them in a half-hearted kind of way. And you get a torch and you're both wandering around their garden looking under the rocks and you're feeling really quite aversive, thinking, oh, God, you know, why did they put a key under a rock? What a stupid thing to do. Or you could think, oh, something else has come into my life. Yeah, I was watching my favorite program. Now something else has happened. Let me just meet that with an open heart. And you and your neighbor are going around the garden looking under the rocks. You're laughing. You're having fun. You're thinking, this is mad. This is crazy. The neighbor's saying, oh, I'm really sorry. You know, this is a really dumb thing to do. And you're saying, yeah, well, never mind, you know. And you find the key. It's all good. And then you invite them into your house for a cup of tea. Because by now, you're really having a good time. You know, you're laughing. You're meeting your neighbor. Maybe they've... you've not really talked to them before. It's like, wow, I really like my neighbor. They come in for a cup of tea and you have a really good time and you're really connected. And I think that's a good example of Tonglen. You know, you have given up. I'm watching my TV program. Do not disturb me. I'm holding on. You've given up. You've let go of all that. And you've shared your humanity. You've met their suffering, which is their standing on your doorstep, shivering and cold and can't get into their house. You've met that with an open heart. And then everyone ends up a winner. They're happy. You're happy. You're having a nice time. You've got to know your neighbor. You've had a laugh. You've had a cup of tea. Yeah, so I think that's quite a good example. And we all know what that feels like. You know, it's not some very, it's not some strange, weird thing where I've got to exterminate myself and only care about others. It's this kind of what Bante says, this expansion of the self. And we're training so that that becomes our default setting. That becomes the default setting. Whatever comes along and arrives on our doorstep, we meet it with an open heart, with a loving heart, and with a heart of connection. Yeah, so I think it's quite simple. You know, when we hear the text, it can all sound very foreign and very strange and maybe a bit, you know, we've got to become a doormat, just have people walking all over us, or be a martyr. It's not that at all. We're just remembering, I have this in me and I'm going to train in this. And by training in this, I am softening this aversion, don't want mind, and this is mine mind. And that is a doorway to freedom for you and for other people. Yeah, so I think it really is quite simple in a way. And I think my work with Breathworks is also, I think, quite a good example, because what I've done is I'm suffering, and then I've developed this kind of way of being in the world, which is encountering, working with other people's suffering to help them have less suffering. Now you could think logically that is such a stupid thing to do. You know, you've got loads of suffering, so why the hell would you then, you know, engage with other people's suffering? Surely I should just be trying to have a nice, easy life, put my feet up, you know, and be wary of other people's suffering. But what's happened is I have become much, much happier. I've become, you know, much, much happier, much more fulfilled, much more lighthearted, laugh more because of this engagement with the wider humanity and using my own experience as this kind of touchstone of empathy with others. Yeah. I think we won't do this next bit because we haven't got time. Yeah, it's all right. And you're going to do something tonight, aren't you? Yeah. So yeah, cherish your dharmic conundrums. If something really provokes you, I mean, this is another verse in the mind training. I think it goes something like, if something provokes you, hold it close. Something like, it's very, very good. If you're provoked, that's great. If you're thinking, I hate that teaching and I think it's wrong, and, you know, why would anyone ever say that? It's good. You know, think, oh, that's great. Let me really dig into that. Let me chew over it. Let it roll around in my heart and my mind. Let me be provoked and see what emerges. And I'm pretty sure that everything I've said about exchanging self and other is true to a point. But I also think I have way further to go. You know, it's quite possible that it is literal. I don't know. You know, if one was really resting in free mind. But I don't know. Yeah, but I feel I'm on a journey of discovery. I'm keeping on being on the edge of my understanding. I think it through. I come up with stories, images, metaphors, and that's very engaging. So please do that in your own lives. So let's do a little practice together now. And then we're going to finish with something else, which is also exciting. So you can look forward to that. I'm not going to tell you what it is. You can look forward to it whilst being in the present. That's the koan. Let's drop in again. Rest deeply. Just yielding, arriving, settling, letting all the words just wash away. Coming into presence, coming into the body. Coming to breathing, softening the diaphragms, the five B's of the breath, the bottom, the belly, the back, the base of the skull, the brain. Just resting inside the universe within for a few moments. Posture, sensation, Vedana, Chitta. Mental events. See, we can soften our compulsions a little bit. Let go of the tight fist, pushing and shoving against experience. Seeing if we can bring kindliness to everything. So if there's anything that feels particularly contracted and tight in our own experience, we can include that in awareness, breathe it in and breathe out, release. A little bit more ease, a little bit more kindliness. Just as we have, in a way, become aware of and perhaps softened these automatic reactions within ourselves or pushing away the unwanted, holding on to things that we like. Let's now soften these reactions in relation to other. So bringing to mind everybody here in our own way, you can do this however you like, just experiment and play. Might be a general sense, or you might choose an individual. If there's anything that you're aversive to, and it might be their suffering, you just don't want to open to their suffering. Just soften that aversion by breathing in tenderly, gently. And let's share our wealth with this person. Don't hold on to our goodness. Don't think it will be diminished through sharing. But let the goodness in our own heart flow out towards these people, and we will all benefit. You will benefit through the arising of the fruits of generosity, the fruits of openness, and they will benefit by receiving your love. So just playing around in your own way. I won't say anything for the next several minutes. I use that as an opportunity to experiment and play.